Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Come on. We're going to be here all day. So we need to get some energy out. Hi, my name is Leha Goh. I'm very, very pleased that we're running this series of workshops with the team Dependent Origination. So very grateful to Ajahn Brumali and Venerable Sunil for doing the workshops. I just have a few things to mention this morning. So, I actually asked the monks for their bios because there might be people who are new to this. And I believe we've got quite a number of people who have joined online. So I should have checked with Jake how many we have. But anyway, so I'd just like to mention a little bit about the monks. Perhaps not so much of Ajahn Brumali since most people know him. So all that I'll say is that he's a senior monk from Bodhiyana Monastery. That doesn't do a lot of justification. Anyway, we've got the bios of the monks posted on the wall, so you can have a look. And with Venerable Sunil, he's done...
That's me.
He's done one talk. No, you've done in Dhammaloka?
One here.
Sutta class?
Yes.
Yeah, one sutta class. And if you go to the BFWA website, you'll see that he has done a number of talks during the COVID lockdown period, which is quite interesting. So, very quickly, so Venerable Sunil is from Netherlands, and after uni and some distractions, as what he mentioned to me.
What are those distractions? We want to know about those distractions.
Those are private.
Okay, he said some private distractions. And so then he came over to Perth and he ordained as a monk. So he, at the young age of 25, and he's been a monk now for 7 years?
Well, I've been in Bodhiyana for 7 years.
Okay.
A monk for five?
Five? Yeah. Okay. And Venerable Sunil has been teaching Pali in Bodhiyana. He's taken over from Ajahn Brumali because that's what Ajahn used to do, right? Yeah. Okay. So that's Venerable Sunil. So yeah, really pleased to, I've invited both of them to do these talks because I've done the early Buddhism class that started in 2013 and I really liked it. Then we kept pestering the monk, can you do talks? And they're traveling, right? They're like, we have to share the monks with the world. So then we had the second series, which was the Karma and Rebirth. I don't even remember which year it was.
I can't either, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway. So, I'm glad that we now have this. Okay, so just very quickly, to in case you have not read what the program is for today. So we are starting at 8:30 for each of the workshops. This will go on until 10:20. That's when we will break for lunch. For lunch, I've asked that people bring their own food because we are afraid that too many people will get into the community hall. I think we can take up to like 80 people. If you want to go there and we've not met that capacity, you're welcome to join. But otherwise, just have your lunch around on the property. Then we'll resume again at 12 and you will run all the way to 2 o'clock. That will be the session 2. Then we'll do an hour break from 2 to 3. Then that will be followed by the last session from 3 to 5. The plan is that for the 3 to 5 session, we might do a breakout session. Ajahn will have some things for us to discuss within that group. So that's basically the program for today and for the next 5 Saturdays. So with this, thanks everyone for being here and thanks the monks for doing this. I'll hand it over to Ajahn Brumali and Venerable Sunil.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Leha. Can you hear me okay? No? You have to fix things up, Carl, so see, make sure this works all right. I'll just sit my natural position. Okay. So welcome. Nice to see you all. And we're going to have some exciting weeks ahead of us. It's going to be 6 sessions all together on dependent origination. And very interesting, very exciting thing. And one of the nice things about this right now, we're in the middle of the COVID season, the COVID problems around the world. And when we are in the middle of a kind of big problem like this, usually people become a little bit more wise at that time. They become interested in spiritual teachings. It's a good time to talk about dependent origination. And this link between it's actually quite interesting, this link between COVID and wisdom, and suffering and wisdom is one of those fundamental things you find in the Buddhist teachings. And one of the fascinating things is that the COVID is the suffering here, and then there is a word in Pali called COVIDO. COVIDO, and COVIDO means like wisdom, yeah, intelligence. So COVID leads to COVIDO straight away here. And we actually have a monk at the monastery who's going to be ordained probably one of these days. And I'm going to suggest to him, his name should be COVIDO. Yeah, and then he will always remember about the COVID season when he started out his monastic life, which is really, I think, very useful. So, and the interesting thing about this idea of COVIDO is also that COVIDO is a word, a Pali word, which is built up of ko and vid. And the word vid is the same word you find at the very beginning of dependent origination. Avidya, yeah, ignorance, is actually the same word as the word vid in COVID and COVIDO. It means like wisdom. The same word you find in English as well in wit and all of these things. We'll talk more about that later on. So all of these things are related to each other. We're going to talk about dependent origination, which is a very, to my mind, very interesting topic for many reasons, because it is very broad and it includes a lot of the Buddhist teachings. Everything is really, everything can be seen through the prism of dependent origination. So very, very fascinating teaching here. And we can bring in almost everything that we want in Buddhism into this one teaching here. So we're going to try, actually that's impossible, isn't it? We're going to bring in as much as we can within these 6 weeks. But the other thing that we're going to do, which I think is very important to do on these occasions, is not to make it too theoretical or abstract. Yeah, it's because sometimes things get too abstract even in Buddhism, but to make it practical. Why should we learn about dependent origination? What can it do to our life? How can we apply this in such a way that it actually makes a difference in how we live day to day, moment to moment, and whatever else it is? I think this is one of those very critical things in Buddhism, that things don't become just intellectual fodder or intellectual food, but actually they have a deeper purpose. And this is what we're going to, this is what makes this, hopefully will make this especially interesting over these 6 weeks. And if we go too far astray into the intellectual realm, then please bring us back to reality again. That's an important point. I should also say that the people who suggested this course was not Venerable Sunio, not me. We didn't come up with this idea. It came from some of the lay people, And I think it's marvelous if you have ideas for the Dhamma, how you would like to see it presented. Because we have the standard way of giving the Friday night talks at Dhammaloka all the time, which is marvelous. That's probably always going to be the mainstay of Dhammaloka, the Friday night talks. But I think it's important that we try to present the Dhamma in fresh ways, alternative methods, like having a more in-depth course that lasts for a certain amount of time. I think this can be very useful. So don't be afraid of coming up with ideas. Certainly, I think we're all very open to that and do things in new ways. So this then is going to be about this one topic over a long period of time, and hopefully we can then go into a fair amount of depth on this particular topic here. One of the important points about this is that we're going to look at dependent origination from a particular point of view, and that is the point of view of early Buddhism. And as Lei Har just mentioned just a while ago, not sure where she went, disappeared. There you are, okay. As she mentioned just a while ago, we did these workshops on early Buddhism back in 2013-14, around there sometime. We did one first on just early Buddhism, and the second one on Kamma and rebirth in early Buddhism. And it was very well attended and very successful. And I think the reason why it was well attended is that I think people have this intuition that early Buddhism actually matters. We all know that Buddhism has a very long history. We know it has developed enormously over those 2,500 years. And so there's always the question, what is the core? What is the essence of the Buddhist teachings? And then going back to the early teachings, going back to the source where all this comes from is actually, I think, enormously important. I think people kind of get that intuitively, that these things matter. Otherwise, it becomes more like a cultural thing. What is Buddhism in our culture?
which of course is important as well, but to really come to the core of things, you have to go back to these essential early teachings. So I'm going to move on to the first slide over here, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the early Buddhist texts, what they are, etc. So I'm going to talk about that in a second. Is there anything you would like to add, Venerable Sunil?
I very much liked your introduction, and I agree that we shouldn't make this dependent origination too theoretical, and that we want to make it practical and also fun, and we all want to get something meaningful out of this. It's in times of crisis like COVID, it's not only that we search for wisdom, we also search for something that we can rely on, something stable, in a sense. And this sort of brings us back to the early Buddhist texts as well, because these early Buddhist texts, they have been going around for 2.5 millennia now, so 2,500 years, and people have relied on those texts for all that time. And these texts bring us something to rely on, that we can fall back on whatever happens in the world outside, like in these times of COVID. We may get all distracted by these things and politics and whatever, but those are like waves on the surface, if you will, of life. And it always, even as a monk, sometimes I get too distracted about external things. And then when I reflect back on Dhamma, like Dhamma means the teachings of the Buddha, and that includes dependent origination, I always feel some sense of peace. Even if sometimes some of the Dhamma, some of the teachings seem maybe a bit unrelatable, you can still feel some truth in them, some truth that goes beyond all these external and temporary things. So I hope we can bring some of that across to you, that same kind of feeling that I'm sure Venerable Bermali also has. This relying on the Buddhist teachings as something that we can always lean on, that we can always fall back on. So I hope we can do that. And I also realize it's Halloween today, isn't it? And also full moon. So this is I like our Halloween party right here. So. No scary monsters, unless you think we are like scary. Scary. We are the most Halloween dressed of all of you here. But it's full moon, and in the Buddha, in the Dhammapada, has a quote, and he says, maybe it's not in the Dhammapada, but somewhere he says, whoever understands the Dhamma, he brightens up the night sky like a moon disappear that appears from behind the cloud. So when it's full moon night, I don't know if you ever went out in a really dark full moon night, like when we do that in the forest, you don't need a torch at all. The moon is really bright. But when it's behind the cloud, then you stumble over everything, and you may step on all sorts of snakes or whatever, so that's not good. But when the moon appears from behind the clouds, then you can see. So this is similar to independent origination. When you see dependent origination, it's like a cloud disappears from inside your mind and things brighten up. Life becomes, you see more. So that's also, I hope that we can celebrate Halloween in that way, by making our minds a bit brighter and seeing things a bit more clearly. Can I tell my Halloween joke? I made up a Halloween joke this morning. I made it up. It's about a vampire, but it really sucks. All right, sorry about that. I've got some more maybe later.
So. Okay. Thank you, Venerable
Bermali. Talk about the early texts.
Excellent. So you don't actually have to see the full moon then, because the full moon kind of arises in your mind. Is that what you're saying about the full moon? Yeah. Kind of comes out in your mind when you Yeah. That's our job, is to kind of make the full moon arise in people's minds. That's kind of what we this is about.
Hopefully. Yeah.
Hopefully. Okay. Okay. Marvelous. Okay. So let's move on to the first slide. Okay. The second one.
Ah. Why doesn't it move? Is it supposed to work here?
Ah. IT problems already.
What did you do here?
I don't know. I clicked.
You clicked. Okay. Gee, okay. Okay. Well, it will sort it out somehow. It will work out.
Yeah. I think you have to click instead of scroll.
Click instead of scrolling. Okay. Okay. Stay there. So, the early Buddhist texts, I'm going to talk a little bit about this by way of introduction, just to get us started. And then I'm going to talk about dependent origination in relation to the early Buddhist texts. What does it mean for dependent origination itself? There's no need for that. So the early Buddhist texts, when we talk about this, what we are talking about is those texts that come at the very fountainhead, at the very beginning, the wellspring of Buddhism. They are the very kind of starting of the Buddhist tradition. So the question is, can we know with any degree of certainty what those texts are? And those texts, of course, are the texts that are supposed to be the word of the Buddha itself. And if you do the necessary research, I would argue that it's actually quite clear that we know what those texts are. And we can be fairly certain, I would argue, that all of these texts, they come from one source, one person, because they are very homogeneous, they all fit together very beautifully, they are just expansions on each other. There's this kind of interlockedness about these early Buddhist teachings, and they refer to each other back and forth. There's something about them which makes it feel as if they come from one source. So how can we know what these texts are? How can we kind of single out the most important ones from everything else? And the way to do this, and it's actually very straightforward once you understand how this works. You can imagine if you have a text in the English language, a modern English literature, whatever that might be, you know, an essay by Ajahn Brahm or something like that. Or is that literature? Maybe it is. I'm being naughty now. I hope Ajahn Brahm can't hear this.
He's probably watching on YouTube.
He's probably watching in his QT, yeah. No, but whatever, you have a modern English text, or whatever, whoever has written it. Then you compare that text with, say, something that was written 100 years ago, or 200 years ago, 150 years ago, 400 years ago. And if you do that, straight away you will know that these texts are not written at the same time. A text that was written, say, by Charles Darwin or something like that in the mid-19th century, or by Dickens or something like that, which is maybe more applicable in this particular case, Charles Dickens, if you compare that with a modern writing, straight away you know that this is not the same time period. If you go further back, if you go back to the time of Shakespeare, for example, and you read Shakespeare, you're already starting to have difficulties understanding it sometimes. You still recognize it quite clearly as English, and you still can read it, but sometimes it's getting difficult. With Charles Dickens, it's quite easy to read, but you recognize straight away that this is a literature from a different time period. Why is it? How is it that we can actually recognize this? And the way you recognize that is because you see in the text that the vocabulary is slightly different. He uses words that are now considered archaic, Charles Dickens. The way they express themselves, the sentence structure, or the kind of the way the language, the style of the language, is also going to be different. In those days they used longer sentences and that kind of thing. And the way they express themselves might be more flowery or something like that. Then you look at the ideas that are expressed. The ideas expressed by Charles Dickens are quite different from the ideas you find today. They talk about different things. They talk about society in a different way, different social institutions that existed at that time, with the chimney sweepers crawling down the chimneys and this kind of things. You don't get that anymore. These days it's a bit more, you have this long kind of rods and you kind of sweep the chimney that way instead. At least that's what they do at Bodhinyana Monastery when we remember to sweep our chimney, which is usually never. So usually the chimney clogs up before you have a chance to sweep it, so you get all the smoke coming into the room. Okay, time to sweep the chimney, so we call somebody. But we don't crawl into the chimney anymore like we did in Charles Dickens' times. And all of these things, the different ideas, the different social institutions, the different way of doing things, immediately tells you that this is a text from a different era. Yeah, you know that with almost absolute certainty. And it doesn't take that much time before a text starts to become archaic. If you read an English text from 1950s, already it starts to feel a little bit archaic when you read it today. And the interesting thing is that exactly the same principle applies to Pali texts. Yeah? If you read a Pali text, say you read the early suttas, and you compare it to the Abhidhamma. For those of you who don't know, the Abhidhamma is like a philosophical work that was maybe was written, it's a bit uncertain, between 200 and 400 years after the Buddha. If you compare the two, you will see exactly this. The vocabulary has slightly shifted. The style of writing is quite different. Yeah, the way every paragraph is introduced, for example, the list of synonyms that is applied in the Abhidhamma, the entire structure of the language is quite different. The ideas are different. The Abhidhamma ideas rely on the earlier texts, but the earlier texts have almost had nothing really about Abhidhamma in them at all. Occasionally they may have that, but that is like early expressions of the Abhidhamma, sometimes intrude in the Pali texts, but there is no real reference to Abhidhamma as such. So all of these things make it very clear what is early, what is late. Yeah, and it's very from that point of view, it's actually quite easy to separate the different layers of text out. And what we find when we do that, which is very fascinating, you find that there is a group of texts that all have roughly the same kind of style. And then there are other groups of texts which have a later style, and other groups of texts that have an even later style, and you can kind of nicely classify, stratify these things chronologically, depending on when they were written, and you get a very clear idea of what is early Buddhist texts. So, let me see if I can get the next slide up here. Hi! How did you do that, sir?
What I clicked.
Oh, no. Ah, that's the one. Okay.
Oh, no.
Oh.
Why is it not just normally work? Okay.
What, this one here?
Space bar.
Okay.
Space bar works.
Okay. So these texts then that come at the very early point, these are the source of Buddhism. And I will give you an example of how exciting it is to find these kind of sources. There was the British Empire being kind of very large around the world back in the 19th century, mid-19th century. The size of the British Empire allowed for a new way of thinking about Buddhism that hadn't really been considered before. Because prior to that, every country had kind of been separate. So there was a Buddhist tradition in Sri Lanka. There was another Buddhist tradition related in Burma. There was a Buddhist tradition in China. But they were all kind of separated. And there was no overview of what all those traditions had in common. And then the British came around, and the British had all this kind of, I'm not going to talk about any about the history of this, but the British kind of were all over the world, pretty much, pretty greedy in one way, just grabbing everything for themselves. And maybe I shouldn't say that. Anyway, I've said it too late. Can't take it back. But what happened, of course, when the British did that they had access to the local cultures in all those countries, and they were able to compare those cultures. And one of those very interesting things that came from that was a Buddhist scholar called Samuel Beal. He was one of the very first scholars to actually look into Buddhist texts of different Buddhist traditions. He was an Englishman. He had taught himself Chinese, so he could read ancient Chinese, which actually is quite difficult. Even those of you who know Chinese will know that ancient Chinese is not easy to read. And then he also had access to the Pali sources. Yeah? So he was one of the first people in history who had the ability to compare Chinese Buddhist texts with Pali Buddhist texts. It had not really been done before because this country had been so separated. And what he found, it was very exciting for Samuel Beal, what he found, one of the first texts that he studied was the Patimokkha texts. Patimokkha is the rules of the monastics, large set of rules. And when he took those rules in Chinese, ancient Chinese language, and compared it to the Pali language, what he found was that they were almost identical. And imagine the shock, you have two completely separate things, two cultures that haven't been in contact, maybe for hundreds, maybe thousands of years, completely separated. Very little. Actually, there has been some contact between those cultures, but not that much. And yet, here you are, these two completely different languages. It is said that Chinese and Sanskrit, or Sanskrit or Chinese and Pali, is impossible to get further apart as far as languages are concerned. They're very different kinds of languages. One is a very grammatical language, whereas in Chinese characters, there's almost no grammar at all. Yeah, one is like they're very different languages anyway. Yeah? And so imagine the shock, yeah, when he saw that. Yeah? And then, once he realized that these rules are almost exactly the same in Chinese as they are in Pali and other languages, he made the prophecy that when we go further into these texts and we compare all the early Buddhist texts, the Agamas, the Nikayas, these things, what we will find is more of the same. We will find that, in fact, all the suttas that exist in common between the Chinese and also the Pali tradition. That was his prophecy. He didn't know at the time. He hadn't studied it yet. But lo and behold, it turned out to be true. Yeah? Over time, we have studied these things more and more, and you can actually see that there is a certain corpus of texts that exists across the board in ancient Chinese, in some of the Tibetan suttas, in Sanskrit remnants found, you know, far away in the deserts of Afghanistan and Pakistan, in the Pali and everywhere. And that common core of suttas, that is then what we call the early Buddhist teachings. Why? Because they exist precisely in so many different schools. Yeah, they exist everywhere. They must have come from a common source. That's the only way you can explain that. And that common source, of course, then goes back all the way to the time of the Buddha. And that is where it all came from. So that is the source of Buddhism. That is the source of these teachings. And this is, I think, fundamentally important thing. It really matters enormously. And the reason it matters... Yay, it worked. And the reason it matters is because there is one thing that we all have to agree on, and that is that the Buddha had something special to say. If you are a Buddhist, we all cannot take the Buddha as our teacher. Yeah, the Buddha is there in the background at all times. And so if we know what the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago, it actually gives the entire Buddhist tradition, it gives it meaning. Yeah. Why? Because everything refers back to that. Without the Buddha, nothing is really meaningful. Imagine if you remove the Buddha out of the equation, and all you have is this kind of vast amount of people saying different things. Yeah, nothing really has any meaning without the Buddha, because all the other teachings refer back to that. Take the Buddha away, there's nothing to refer back to. So the early Buddhist texts give everything else meaning. And the problem with so many of these Buddhist texts that we have is that they are very often anonymous. Take things like the Abhidhamma. We don't know who taught the Abhidhamma. Take many of the Mahayana suttas, for example. We don't really know who wrote those suttas. There's no author. Take the Pali commentaries. The Pali commentaries were collected by a monk called Buddhaghosa, but we don't really know the source of those commentaries either. Yeah, so all of these things are very, very uncertain. And because they are uncertain, it is incredibly useful to be able to go back to the source of everything, the Buddha himself, that kind of makes this whole house of cards, we call cards called Buddhism, gives it a foundation, a proper solid kind of surface on which everything else rests. This is the real meaning of these, why these teachings matter so much. So these teachings then, they become the gold standard for what is real Buddhism. Yeah. So if we have any doubt as to whether a particular teaching is right or wrong, whether it makes any sense or not, you come back to the early Buddhist teachings and you compare it with that. So you may think that is quite difficult. Yeah, maybe some of you haven't read all the suttas yet. Maybe you don't read Pali on a daily basis. I don't know. But if you don't, it is it is true that some of the subtleties of the suttas can be quite hard to understand unless you have done a lot of research. But there are things that will become very clear straight away when you start reading the suttas. Yeah, and this is kind of the nice thing about it. You don't necessarily have to know all the details to be able to fathom some of the basic principles. And some of the things I really like to point out always is that one of the, you know, very often in Buddhism we have all these arguments about how to practice the path. Should we practice samatha? Should we practice vipassana? Should we practice them together? And all of these kind of things. Is jhana necessary or whatever? And these are actually fairly superficial questions when it comes to the Pali canon or the suttas, because you get an answer to these things straight away when you read the suttas. So this is the gold standard. We come back to these things, yeah? So when we're going to talk about dependent origination, we also want to come back to these suttas. So what are these suttas? Where do we find them? What are these things that make up this coherent whole, if you like, which we can call the word of the Buddha? And they are mainly in the Pali language, they are known as the four Nikayas. Nikaya means like a collection, yeah? Quite literally means a collection. And these four collections are the collection of long discourses, middle-length discourses, Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, connected discourses, Samyutta Nikaya, and the numerical discourses, which is called the Anguttara Nikaya. There is a little bit more than that, but that is the main essence of what these things are. So if you want to read the word of the Buddha, you can go over to the library over there, and the Buddha is right there in the library waiting for you. Yeah, sitting behind the desk saying, please read this. And that is how you get direct access to these teachings of the Buddha. But it's not just in the Pali language, because as I mentioned, these teachings are also found in Chinese translation, in Tibetan translation, in all of these kind of, in many, many different places. And so you can, you know, compare and kind of bring out the meaning of these texts by doing this. So I would really recommend you to have a look at the word of the Buddha. It is marvelous. It is beautiful. It is full of nice similes, nice metaphors. It's a marvelous thing to be able to read those things for yourself and feel almost like you're sitting at the feet of the Buddha, yeah, listening to a discourse. It really is getting into the presence of the Buddha when you read these suttas. It's like the Buddha is there. He's teaching you. Yeah, this is it. And this is one of those feelings that you should kind of hopefully give rise to when you start to hear the suttas. It's kind of a magnificent feeling when you feel that you are there in the presence of the Buddha. So let me just show you what one of these... I was just talking about the various languages that these suttas exist in. Let me show you one example of these languages. Yeah. So I hope you can read this. Can you read that? Hard to read, right? So this here is a ancient birch bark manuscript. This manuscript was found in what is now the north of Pakistan or the eastern parts of Afghanistan. Yeah, the way up there where you have Kabul, you have the Khyber Pass, and you have all of these areas in the north up there. And this language that you can see there. This is called Gandhari is this particular language. Gandhari is one of the ancient languages of India. And it's similar in many ways. It's related to Sanskrit. It's related to Pali and all of that. But it is slightly different because the language obviously changes according to which part in India you are. And this, the characters you see there, this is called the Kharoshthi alphabet. There were two main alphabets used in India at this time, and that was the Brahmi alphabet. The Brahmi alphabet was used for the inscriptions of the Ashokan pillars. And then there was the Kharoshthi alphabet that was used in the northwest of India, where these particular manuscripts were found. And this manuscript, you want to think, you have any idea when it dates from? You want to make a guess when it dates from? It dates from roughly the 1st or the 2nd century AD. Yeah, so this manuscript is basically 2,000 years old and is still preserved, yeah, in the deserts of Afghanistan. It's kind of amazing, isn't it, to have an object that's 2,000 years old And of course, because it's so old, it's incredibly fragile, and it breaks apart. You almost breathe on this things and kind of falls apart and it blows into pieces. So you have to take care of it. You have to have incredibly specialized technology to look after these kinds of manuscripts. So they are handled by some of the greatest experts around the world to make sure they look after properly. So what does it say? What do we find when we read these manuscripts? First of all, you have to have super duper expert knowledge to be able to read this. Yeah, you have to understand these ancient alphabets. You have to understand the Gandhari languages. There is maybe, you know, 3 or 4, or maybe 5 experts in the world who can read this. I am not one of those experts. I would be cool to be, but I'm not. So I'm not that cool. But so what do you find when you read this? And what you find, what is fascinating, is that part of what you find are exactly the suttas of early Buddhism. Yeah, that's only part of it, but that is one of the things you find. So if you're able to read this, I'm not sure exactly about this particular one here, you will find that it will be parallel to some sutta found in the Pali Nikayas, even though it is found in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is about 3,000 kilometers away from Sri Lanka, yeah? And that is straight line. If you go by ox cart, it's even longer, but in a straight line, it's a long way. But basically, you find exactly the same thing. 2,000-year-old manuscript, which gives you the suttas, yeah, right there, and you recognize it when you compare it to the Pali here. Isn't that kind of astonishing here? I find that kind of really amazing, yeah, and it gives you this really strong feeling that these actually are the words of the Buddha. What can this? How can this possibly be the case that across all of these cultures, all of these distances, we have things that are so similar, almost exactly the same? Well, the only way that is possible, really, as far as I can see, is that it has this common source, which is early, which is really the word of the Buddha, going back 2,500 years ago. So anyway, this is just an introduction about the early Buddhist text. And Venerable Senior, would you like to add anything to what I said here?
Yeah, about these early Buddhist texts, I forgot to put in a picture of some other manuscripts. The reason that these manuscripts are so old and well-preserved is, as Ajahn Brahmali said, they were found in a desert. And the desert are quite dry, so these kind of leaf manuscripts, they don't deteriorate so much because of the climate. And in the countries like Sri Lanka, India, Thailand, the climate is much wetter. So these leaf birch, they wouldn't have birch, but palm leaves they would have had, those deteriorate much faster. So we don't have texts that are as old as these. However, in Burma, they found a grave of some kind of king or some kind of rich bloke, anyway. And what they found there were leaves made out of gold. So palm leaves made out of gold, and they were inscribed with early Buddhist texts.
Do you have seeds for that palm leaf made of gold?
Have what?
Do you have the seeds for that palm made of gold? Palm tree made of gold? That would be cool.
Yeah. Gold coconut.
Gold coconut.
But so fascinating thing is, if you are some kind of rich guy and you would have the opportunity to preserve some Buddhist text in gold, what would you put on there? Would you put on there Namo Tassa Bhagavato, we bless the Buddha, something like that? That would be very natural. What would you put on there? You know what they put on there? Right on the first sheet and going on, like 5 or 6 sheets, dependent origination was on there. So that is actually the earliest Pali text. That is like we have the physical, by early text I mean physical text. Yeah, the text go back further than that, but the physical evidence, the physical leaf, the oldest one is that one from Burma, and that's on dependent origination. So that shows you how central and important this text has always been to Buddhists, and it really gives you a link back to the past, because these are from, and it's a bit hard to date, but I think they dated it from like around the 4th century or 5th century
of this era. So it's still quite a bit after the Buddha, like 800 years after the Buddha, but it's much longer from those texts to us than it is back to the Buddha, if you get what I'm saying. The distance in time between the Buddha and those texts is shorter than the distance in time from those texts to us. So it brings us back in time and to dependent origination. So I find that quite nice. So maybe you can talk a bit more about
that. That's very interesting, isn't it? I remember you pointed that out to me, and I wasn't sure why you pointed to that manuscript, but of course, because it has dependent origination on it. It's fascinating, isn't it? Yeah,
this is very important point. What it has on there.
Yeah, exactly. So we're just following the footsteps of the ancient Burmese kings, really, for this class. Yeah, that's marvelous. Okay, so now let us move on, because we have there's more important things. This is just the background, really. So what I'm going to talk about now is how does this idea of early Buddhist text, how does it apply to dependent origination? Because what does it mean? In other words, is there a dependent origination that is early, that was taught by the Buddha? And is there kind of later versions of dependent originations that might be distortions of the early word of the Buddha? This is an important point. Yeah, is there a reason why we should go back to the early Buddhist texts when it comes to dependent origination? So I'm going to look at dependent origination in history, if you like, and how. This is very, very brief. I'm not going to talk about this at length at all, just to give you some idea. So the earliest aspect, again, is found in the early Buddhist texts. And what you find in the early Buddhist text is a very coherent idea of dependent origination. You find it in many different suttas. There is a whole collection of suttas called the Nidana Sanyutta, the connected discourses basically on dependent origination. There's about 70 suttas there on this particular topic. And it's also found around the other collections as well, not just in the connected discourse, but also, as I mentioned before, the long discourse, the middle discourses. Everywhere you find this teaching. It's a core aspect of Buddhism. Yeah, it's obviously very important. And we will look at that importance a little bit later on. So the question then is, is there a problem? Is there any particular reason why we need to go back to the early Buddhist text? Are there later distortions? So the first thing which is useful, I'm going to talk about this very briefly again, is dependent origination in the Abhidhamma. Yeah, because you would think that in the Abhidhamma, then perhaps there would be a development in this idea. I should say, before I talk about the Abhidhamma, I should say that one of the interesting things about the early Buddhist text is that if you go to the various traditions of Buddhism, the various different schools of Buddhism, I talked about the early Buddhist texts in different languages. The different languages often has to do with different schools that relate to the early divisions in the Sangha, where they went to different areas and they started to develop sometimes their own particular doctrines. But what is interesting about it, and even in Mahayana Buddhism, is that the dependent origination basically looks exactly the same in all of these various schools. I have somewhere on my little laptop here, I have a dependent origination in Sanskrit, which obviously existed. It was found in the north of India. And when you look at the dependent origination in Sanskrit, you look at all the factors, it is almost virtually identical with what you find in the Pali. Yeah? So all of these early texts, the ideas expressed are exactly the same, which is very reassuring. Yeah, it's a very important point. This is a very homogenous idea about dependent origination. So what about the Abhidhamma? Now, one of the things about the Abhidhamma is that the Abhidhamma tries to sometimes develop a new approach, a philosophical approach to the Buddhist teachings. And for that reason, it varies sometimes. Yeah? It is not exactly the same thing as what you find in the suttas. Otherwise, there would be no point in writing the Abhidhamma. If you're going to write exactly the same thing, you might as well go back to the suttas. Yeah? So if you're going to write something new, you have to kind of come up with some new ideas. So in the Abhidhamma, it gives you two ways of thinking about dependent origination. One is called the Suttanta Bhajaniya, Yeah, I always say I have to use a few Pali words because it gives me more authority. If you don't understand what I'm saying, yeah, it gives me a bit more authority. So I always like to kind of put in a few kind of fancy words in there. So Sutanta Bhajaniya, and then you have the Abhidhamma Bhajaniya, which is, and Bhajaniya means analysis, and Sutanta is the suttas, Abhidhamma is in the Abhidhamma. So the analysis according to the suttas, and the analysis according to the Abhidhamma. So the analysis according to the suttas is exactly what you would expect. Yeah, it is exactly what you find in the suttas. But then when you come to the Abhidhamma analysis, that is where you start to get a slight variation. So what is that variation? And it's fascinating because this slight variation is sometimes used by modern commentators on Buddhism to say that actually, yeah, here is an opening for interpreting the dependent origination in a new way, but not the kind of standard way. For those of you, we're going to come back to this in a second, but the standard way is to understand dependent origination in terms of something which goes over several lifetimes. Yeah, one life, you get reborn, and it kind of carries on like that. But the modern idea is sometimes to think of dependent origination as something which happens in the moment, momentarily. Yeah, mind moments arising here, and that these words, independent origination, refer to these mind moments. And they argue that the Abhidhamma is the precursor for that idea. And the reason for that is because the word jati in Pali, which means birth or rebirth, yeah, in the suttas, the word jati is defined as basically rebirth. Yeah, beings coming into existence, acquiring of the sense faculties, coming into existence, all of these kind of things. It's very obvious of various beings into various categories of beings. It is very obvious that it actually refers to birth in a very ordinary sense. But then in the Abhidhamma, they bring out this new idea. Instead of beings, they talk about dhammas. Abhidhamma. Dhamma in the Abhidhamma is a quality, yeah, it's a quality of existence. So instead of actually referring to a being, they bring it back to something more, to analyze things into the basic components of existence. That is what the Abhidhamma is about. So you have the Abhidhamma Matika. Matika is like a summary or a index to the Abhidhamma, and it gives you a list of all the various factors of existence. So when the Abhidhamma says, instead of saying beings being reborn, it talks about these dhammas being reborn. Yeah, so you can think maybe of the five khandhas. Instead of just the being being reborn, you can talk maybe about the five khandhas being reborn. And then the argument is that here, the Abhidhamma is talking about something new. Personally, I don't think it's true. I don't think the Abhidhamma actually does that. If you look at the way this is mentioned, all it really means, as far as I can see, is that these qualities or these basic constituents of existence, it is they that are reborn rather than a being being reborn. Because this is how the Abhidhamma works. It doesn't think in terms of beings, it thinks in terms of the constituents of the being. So instead of beings being reborn, it is these constituents that are reborn. And fair enough, you can analyze existence in that way. But other people would argue this actually means that it's not about rebirth at all. It is actually about the arising of these dhammas, moment to moment, the constituents of existence arising moment to moment. But if you look at the words used are exactly the same thing as in the suttas. It's about jati, abhinibhatti, patubhava, which all means appearance, rebirth, and all these kind of things. So I think it's a very tenuous argument, but that is what is being used. So what has that led to? And what it has led to is this. This is some of the modern interpretations of dependent origination. And this is where we have some very famous people. They're one of the most famous scholar monks in Thailand in the 20th century. Was a monk called Buddhadasa, Venerable Buddhadasa, which some of you may have heard of. He was kind of a celebrated scholar in Thailand. And because of his prominence, his ideas became very influential. And one of the things that he was arguing that a dependent origination should be understood, instead of as a rebirth thing, it should be understood as the arising of mental phenomena in the moment, one after the other. One mental phenomena gets born, yeah? Then it dies, another one gets born, and it dies, etc. So this is kind of a modern idea. So where does it come from? Well, first of all, it comes from the idea of interpreting the Abhidhamma in a certain way. then it comes from the needs of a particular culture. You know, one of the interesting things in many traditional Buddhist cultures, as you would expect from any culture, is that the majority of people are going to be, they are Buddhist by birth. They are not necessarily Buddhist by conviction, but Buddhist by birth. So you are a Buddhist and you do the Buddhist things. You never really think all that deeply about the Buddhist teachings. It's a bit like if you are a Christian, you get born in a Christian country. Yeah, I was born in a Christian country. I didn't know anything about Christianity. And actually, I'm quite happy. I don't really mind at all, actually, to be honest with you. I don't really, wasn't all that interested in Christianity, but I didn't know anything. Yeah, Christianity, yeah, something about Jesus, right? And God, that was pretty much it. I was really clueless. Because it's part of your culture. You don't really think about it. And this is true also in, of course, in any culture. You don't think so much about your own culture. So one of the problems that Buddhadasa found in Thai culture, he felt the need to educate the Thai people about what Buddhism was really about. And he felt that Thai Buddhists, all they do is they go to the temple, they make merit. Yeah, okay, I want to give this. Please give me a Mercedes next week. Yeah, so and I really want a Mercedes. Please, please, Buddha. And then you pray to the Buddha, you give an offering to the monks, and then you hope for the Mercedes. And it doesn't work, so you come back next week and do the same. Yeah, until eventually you die. And then, okay, in my next life, I'll get the Mercedes. Yeah, so and it carries on like that. And it becomes a very materialistic kind of spirituality. So he wanted to change people's ideas. And one of the ways of doing that is to focus on the essence of the Dhamma rather than on the superficial things. So instead of thinking about rebirth and how to get that, you know, mansion in your next life and all of that, yeah, you actually focus on the here and now. And that is where these things come from. So when we look at these modern ideas, and we have to be very sensitive to the cultural context and to understand why people like Venerable Buddhadasa, why he taught in this particular way. And I think this is one of the main reasons why he taught the dependent origination in this way. Whether he actually did, I think it's very likely that I don't know if it's clear anyway whether he himself believed in rebirth. I think he probably did, but he didn't emphasize that point. Why? Because it wasn't really what was required in Thailand at that time. This is one example. There are more examples like that. There's a infamous, there was an English monk in Sri Lanka, and he was a bit of a philosopher before he became a monk. So he was very interested in Western philosophy, in part existentialist philosophy. So he then interpreted dependent origination in terms of existentialist philosophy here. Is that a good idea? It's dangerous, right? If you take a Western context that came 2,500 years after the Buddha and you interpret that dependent origination in terms of a modern Western philosophical outlook, you may have some very serious problems. It's the assumption that somehow there is a match between these things is actually very, very dangerous things to do. But that also is a way in which these teachings sometimes get distorted. So all of this, the reason I'm saying all of this is simply to point out that the distortions happen. We need to be very careful. And if we want to find out what dependent origination really is about, we should forget about some of these modern interpretations. There's no real need to read too much about them except to know that they are there. And we should go back to the early sources. And this is what we're going to do, Venerable Sunyo and myself. We're going to go back to those early sources consistently throughout this course to make sure that we get the real deal and we don't actually get sidetracked by these kind of issues. So this is the importance of the early Buddhist texts in the connection of dependent origination here.
I think modern interpretations can have some value also. As you said, in certain contexts, cultural contexts, or for certain people, but yeah, we like to go back to the early Buddhist texts because it brings us closest to the Buddha. So that's what we're doing in this course. And by the way, did you know that wishing for a Mercedes might actually work?
Uh-huh.
When I was staying in Bodhiyana Monastery, and I wasn't a monk yet, I was still visiting as a layperson, and it was my birthday. And Burr came up to me. Burr's not here, I don't think. She's a very strong supporter of the monastery. So she came up to me, "Oh, it's your birthday. What can I get you as a gift?" And I thought, I don't need anything. I'm going to become a monk. But I said, a red Ferrari. I want a red Ferrari. It has to be red. And I was just joking, of course. But you know what happened? 2 minutes later, a red Ferrari drove into the monastery. It really happened. It wasn't for me. But it was there, and it was the only one I've ever seen there, so...
Is that an example of dependent origination?
Mm. No. Maybe a modern interpretation.
Yeah, modern interpretation. Okay, yeah. I think it's true. There are some interesting points to be made with this modern interpretation. But I think the important point is to understand that they are not actually, as far as I'm concerned, an interpretation of dependent origination. They are the usage of an ancient framework in a new way here. And I think that is a slightly different thing here. Because an interpretation means that you are looking at it. But the Abhidhamma actually specifically says that this is not an interpretation of the sutta. This is a new way of looking at it called the Abhidhamma method, which is slightly different. But one of the things I promised at the beginning, I think it's important that we may have this a bit interactive. I really want to give people a chance to ask questions, make comments, bring out your own ideas if you have anything. Yeah. So at any point, I should stop more often. Please remind me to stop, because I just talk, which is kind of crazy sometimes. So if you have any questions at this particular point or anything you want to comment on, there's a microphone going around. Please fire away. Mahinda, please.
Ajahn, you mentioned that Patimokkha documented in Pali and in Chinese, the texts were very similar or identical.
Yeah.
Where do you find that?
Well, I found it. I just found it by reading books about it. Yeah. There is a famous study by I think he is a Chinese scholar called Pat Chao or something like that. And he wrote a comparative study of the Patimokkhas. And so he took all the various Patimokkhas in existence. And there was one in Sanskrit, one in Pali, and in fact 7 versions in Chinese. And he compared all of them. So that is where I originally got the information from. So you can find that. And it's fascinating when you take all of those different Patimokkhas and you compare them with each other. All of them are basically the same. There is one section that is different. There is a minor class of rules called the Sakya rules, the rules of training. They are slightly different, but they are just like a cultural rules almost. They're not really the essential rules of the Vinaya, but the essential rules are the same. Yeah, they are almost verbatim the same. It's kind of astonishing here. I don't know how you keep things so consistently the same over 2,000 years. I don't know how you do that, but somehow they did it. Yeah, to the point where still is almost exactly the same after 2,500 years. It's kind of astonishing. It tells you something about how important these things were for the Buddhist tradition and how carefully they looked after them. So we already have some questions from the outside. So let's just take some of these as we go along here. This is from William Liam. Are venerable monks aware of different translations into English for Patipsasamuppada? Yes, there are a number of different translations used. Personally, I like dependent origination. I think it is a good translation for Patipsasamuppada. Paticca, quite literally, as Venerable Sunyo pointed out to me, quite literally means something like dependent, something. One thing depends on something else. So that's how it is used in the suttas. And samuppada means to arise or to originate. It means to come into existence. So sometimes called dependent origination, sometimes dependent arising. Sometimes you find translations such as dependent co-arising, which to my mind is a bit more problematic because not all of these factors co-arise. Sometimes there is a temporal time gap between the different factors. So the idea of co-arising to me is a bit more problematic. But that is another translation sometimes used. And of course, everybody has their own favorite translation. But my favorite one, the one I prefer, is dependent origination. That's why we use that here. This is from Axel Frick from in Germany. Thank you for this workshop. Okay. At 1:50 a.m. in Germany. Jeepers, Axel, you're really getting in there, aren't you? That's good. I'm glad you are so keen. This is from Jesse C.H. Oh, thank goodness for these live streams. I do not know where I would be without them. The internet is so weird right now, but these talks are so solid. Okay, yay, that's marvelous. Okay, you really got it right, so that's good. Okay, so thank you for that. So anyone else would like to say anything about what we've done so far here? Wow, are you stunned into silence, or are you just too sleepy in the morning still? Saturday morning can be a bit tough. Okay.
At least it's not 1:50 a.m.
At least not 1:50 a.m., yeah. Okay, so let's carry on then, because we have a kind of plan for this. You want to add anything more, Venomous Manuel?
Ah, happy.
You're happy? Okay, marvelous. So,
even I'm stunned in silence. So. Yeah, very good.
Maybe so, one more question.
Please, absolutely.
What was behind the need to take original text and change them later by Buddhists?
What is the meaning?
What's the drive? What caused the changes? Why we've got to go back? Why we don't naturally accept the origins?
Well, I think it is just a human way of doing things. It's like when Basunyo and Maya, when we talk now about these texts, we cannot just read the sutta verbatim. If we did that, you might as well stay at home and read it yourself. Yeah, we have to add something, some explanation. I'm going to have a look now in a second at the bare listing of the 12 factors of dependent origination. And what you will see is that bare listing of those 12 factors, very hard to understand when you see the bare list. Yeah, ignorance, willed activities, consciousness, name and form. And you think, what on earth is going on here? It's really hard to understand. So sometimes you need explanations to bring out the points. And Buddhism has always been like that. Going back to the very beginning, you would have some of the most famous monks and nuns at that time, like Venerable Sariputta Venerable Kema, one of the famous nuns. And they would bring out the meaning of the word of the Buddha, and they would add their own interpretation here. So it is basically, it is just the way things have been done historically to bring out meaning. And then some of these have been written down. Some became the Abhidhamma. Some became the commentaries. Some became the modern ideas. Yeah, because it's just the way that this has to work. So, but again, so we are going to say, Venerable Sunyo and myself, we're going to be saying many things. And I cannot guarantee that everything we say is going to be exactly according to the early Buddhist texts. Yeah, I'm sure we're going to make some mistakes. So please catch us in making mistakes. Yeah, and say, wait a minute. Yeah, and then we will hopefully get it. It's good to have that challenge sometimes, because I also am here to learn. I also would like to, and Venerable Sunyo told me specifically, we're also here to learn, basically. Yeah? And one of the joys of being able to lead a course like this is precisely it allows you to go deeper into the material and learn more yourself about what is going on here. So let's see what happens. So what we're going to do now, I'm going to go very quickly through the factors of dependent origination, just as a way of background. Yeah, is there anyone here who has almost no idea about dependent origination, or are you all kind of really doing really well already? Are you kind of, you know the 12 factors already, most of you? Okay, no? Not Ian. Okay, Ian, okay, good. I thought you would be an expert already, but okay, not expert. Okay, so I'm just going to go through them in case there are people who are joining this course and who don't know much about it. The idea, this course is supposed to be for everyone, yeah, whether you are a beginner or you are a super-duper expert. Many super-duper experts here? Huh? No super-duper experts and no beginners. You're all in between somewhere. Okay, good. So we're all on the same.
Middle way,
yeah. So let's have a look at these 12, an outline of the dependent origination. So it starts off with ignorance. Yeah, this is the beginning of dependent origination. And, okay, so far so good. Yeah. And then what dependent origination says, it says that ignorance, yeah, can translate this in many ways. We're going to come back to this later on. It leads to willed activities, willed actions, willed acts. Yeah, so this is what I said. Dependent origination, when you first read it, it's a bit mysterious. Why does ignorance lead to willed actions? Does that mean that if you are not ignorant, you won't have any willed actions? Does that mean that you will just sit there like a rock? You won't do anything? Arahants, are they like kind of rocks, or are they human beings? So that's kind of, it's a bit mysterious straight away. Yeah, and the next one is, consciousness, willed activities lead to consciousness. And again, the first time you read this, very mysterious. Why is it that willed activities lead to consciousness? And this is meant in a number of different ways, this kind of link here. But one way is that it actually means that it leads to consciousness. Without willed activities, you don't get consciousness in the long run. This is what this says, yeah? But it is a rather mysterious statement. Consciousness then leads to name and form. That is really mysterious, yeah? What does that mean? Consciousness leads to name and form. It's really, really weird. And when you read that first time, you go completely blank, and you just wonder whether you should walk out of the room straight away, because this makes absolutely no sense. Just to give you very briefly, name and form essentially here can be understood as the other aspects of a person apart from consciousness. Yeah, that's really basically what it is. The name and form, in turn, leads to the six senses. Okay, so kind of makes sense, perhaps. If you have a person, you have six senses. Now it becomes a little bit more understandable. Six senses lead to sense impressions. Sometimes called contact. We experience the world through those senses. And when we have those sense impressions, then that leads to sensations. You feel the world, you sense the world through those senses. And this is starting to make sense. Finally, we get something we can understand. And of course, once you have sensations, once you feel the world, then you will either like it or dislike it. So you crave or you discrave. Is that a word? Discrave? For now, it is a word. Okay. You crave or you kind of, ooh, don't want that. Yeah. And that craving leads to taking up. Yeah. Again, we can see how that works. We crave things and I want that ice cream. Okay, take it up. Yeah, ice cream. You pick it up. And then that taking up leads to here life, or it could also be considered existence. Is it getting a bit more obscure again? Why taking up leads to life? So this is not so obvious. We'll see later on why that is the case. And then that life leads to rebirth. Yeah, so why does life lead to rebirth? Again, these are things we're going to describe as we go along. And then rebirth, what does lead to? It leads to old age and death. So if you are born, this is what happens to you. You get older and you die. So maybe birth is bad. Yeah, this is one of those interesting things about Buddhism. We tend to turn things upside down. Usually birth is celebrated around the world. Yay, a baby is born. In the Buddhism is more like, oh no, not another baby. Yeah, now more suffering, more death, old age. So we really like to turn things upside down. Anyway, that is just a very brief outline for those of you who have never seen this before. And you can see it is quite a mysterious teaching here. And it's very difficult to understand this unless you have someone explain what is going on. So this one of the critical things to notice there is the idea of rebirth in the middle there. That's one of the critical things. And I wanted to show you this largely so that you have some idea that rebirth is part of this, so that you can then understand the factors that come afterwards. Okay, so now what we are going to talk about next, once we have seen the outline of these things, later on today we're going to look at all of these factors in more detail. We're going to spend about maybe 45 minutes or an hour looking at all of them. And then the rest of the course is going to be about looking at them in even greater detail. We're going to take out the magnifying glass and even the electron microscope and focus in on each of these factors with great, hopefully not too much, but kind of find that middle way again about what is appropriate. So now what we want to do now is look a bit at the background to dependent origination. What the big view is, about some of the things the Buddha has to say about dependent origination as a sequence, as a whole. One of the things we're going to look at. So let's do that. Dependent origination background. Whoa, okay. We need some more. And so this is the first ones of these backgrounds, that ignorance leads to suffering. I'll just look at those. I'm going to talk about all of them in detail, but this is a very important one because, as we just saw before, ignorance is the very first factor of dependent origination. Old age and death is the last one. Old age and death here is a is a placeholder, if you like. It takes the place of suffering. It's a way of thinking about suffering, old age and death. So dependent origination, really, looking at across all of those 12 factors, is a way of understanding why suffering arises from ignorance. Yeah, I'll talk about that in a second. Then there's the idea that this is a universal principle, yeah, that is always applicable. I'll talk about that in a second as well. The idea that it is a profound teaching. This is something the Buddha states specifically in the suttas. Again, we will look at that in a second. It is a very rich teaching, and that is what makes it so interesting, all the various factors. And finally, that the understanding dependent origination is equivalent to a stream entry. And this is one of the ways to understand why it is so profound. Let's start with the first one. Ignorance leads to suffering here. So it leads to suffering, right? So this is what happens with ignorance. So the idea here, one of the things about, again, dependent origination, one of the things when you have a causal sequence, yeah, I showed you before the 12 factors, they all had a little arrow in there. It means that there is a causal sequence between all of these factors, each one causing the next one or conditioning the next one, if you like. Yeah, and is in a sequence like that, the end points are the most important ones. The beginning point here being ignorance and the end point being suffering. And the reason why these are so important is because the end points shows you the ultimate purpose of dependent origination. This is what it all leads to. This is what it all points to. All of these other factors, they have that as the ultimate purpose to show us about suffering here. And that's good news, yeah? It's nice to know about suffering and happiness. That means we can do something about it, perhaps. So it really comes down to the very basic ideas of what human life is about, the avoidance of suffering and the avoidance of problems, and moving towards more contentment and happiness and all these kind of things. Yeah. So this is what it really is about. So that is the aim of all of this, to understand suffering. And then the first point of dependent origination, that is the root reason why there is suffering. All of the other ones are like intermediate stages, and of course they are very important as well, otherwise they wouldn't be there. But the root problem to this whole thing is the idea of ignorance, or avidya in the Pali language. That is where it all comes from. And there's something nice about that, about taking out all the intermediate steps and just go to the beginning and then to the end. Ignorance leads to suffering. Yeah? Delusion. Alternative translation of the Pali. Delusion, illusion, ignorance, unknowing, all of these things lead to suffering. And there's something very beautiful about that, because it is something that I think we all can intuitively understand and agree with. Yeah, we can all understand that ignorance leads to suffering. This fellow, poor fellow here, he is ignorant of what is going on. He has no idea that he's about to step off a cliff. Yeah, he's ignorant. What does it lead to? Well, presumably it leads to a lot of suffering when it falls down. So it is kind of natural. And we know that from our ordinary lives, when we do something really stupid, we're on the internet, we open the whole email, we're ignorant about that attachment that we shouldn't open, yeah, and our whole computer gets hijacked by some scammer somewhere around the world. Yeah, we have ignorance. We are ignorant about how to get to the Dhammaloka Center, and we don't make it for the dependent origination class. Whoa, now that's big time suffering, yeah? So that is the ignorance about the path leading to Dhammaloka. Any kind of ignorance, when we don't know what we're doing, it always tends to lead to suffering. Sometimes by accident it may not lead to suffering, but generally it does lead to suffering. So it is kind of very intuitive. We understand why this must be the case. But of course, what is interesting about dependent origination, what makes it much more rich and exciting, is that the links in between show us that it leads to suffering in a very particular way. And here is the idea of rebirth comes in, yeah? And that kind of makes it so rich and so interesting when we take into account all of those intermediate steps. But even at a very superficial level, it's very sensible and very intuitive to understand it in this understand what is going on here.
Seeing this slide, Ajahn, I just
realize there's a sutta that exactly says this. Yeah. And Buddha goes with the monks. He goes into the mountains, and one of the monks says, "Oh, I see this real deep cliff there. Is there any cliff in the world, Buddha, that you know of that is any deeper than this?" And the Buddha says, "Yes, I know one cliff that is deeper, and that is when you have ignorance and you don't see things as they really are. And then you step into a real deep cliff." So it's exactly this.
Okay. And maybe this picture is inspired by the sutra. Yeah. <Could be. laughs> That'd be interesting. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That's a good point. Yeah. So anyway, I just thought I would make that point. Let's go on to the next point. The idea that the Buddhist teachings are a universal principle. And this is a quote right here from the suttas. This is one of the things the Buddha has to say about this. And you will notice that when we quote, we always quote from the suttas, pretty much. You won't find many other quotes from us. This is one of these famous quotes. And I'll just read it out for you. Whether Buddhas arise or not, this law of nature persists, this regularity of natural principles, this invariance of natural principles, that is specific conditionality. I've actually taken out the word dependent origination, because they occur in there as well, but it just became too long and it was kind of enmeshed with some other texts. So this is the Buddha talking about dependent origination. Yeah, it is a law of nature that is always there, and it's whether Buddhas arise or not is irrelevant. Yeah, it is irrelevant whether you know about this law or you don't know about this law. It is the underlying nature of reality. This principle, so this is important. Yeah, and this is important because it means that when the world is going down, having lots of problems in the world, I think right now we're going through very interesting times in the world. It's, if you read a bit of news, you read about all the political instability everywhere, you read about all the concerns about climate change and all of these kind of things. COVID seems to be the most tiny problem. All these other ones seem to be far bigger than COVID. COVID seems like peanuts compared to some of these other things. And you kind of feel everything is just shaking. Everything is just unsteady. What am I going to hold on to? What am I going to do? And this is, of course, the point about the teaching of the Buddha, is that they provide you with something to hold on to when there is so much uncertainty in the world. And this is the idea of having a refuge, having something that you can rely on, some way of looking at the world that actually is, that you can have some confidence in, actually, will support you when things get so difficult. And it's not just about dependent origination, of course, it's also about the path of practice also implied in this. And all of these things come in there. So this is the importance of having some universal principle. So this is not just a kind of a theory of the Buddha. It's not a philosophy. It is an insight into the nature of reality. That is what it means. It is a universal principle. It says here, it has this strange word, specific conditionality, at the end there. And you may wonder, what does that mean? And the Pali word for that is idda paccayata. I'm not sure if that helps you very much. But it is specific conditionality means that it is not just a vast number of things conditioning each other, but there are specific conditions, specific causes leading to specific results. That is the idea of dependent origination. And that is why you can have a sequence of 12 factors where there is specific things leading to specific results, all building on each other. That is the idea of specific conditionality. Sometimes you may have seen that, we talk about the how everything is interrelated in the world. Everything being interrelated is one of the things that you sometimes hear in Buddhist circles. And sometimes dependent origination itself is interpreted as everything is interrelated. There is probably some way in which that is true, that almost everything is interrelated in a certain sense. But it is not particularly useful. It's not particularly useful because it doesn't really give you any information on where to apply your energy, how to think about things. to give you some useful information, you need to know specific conditions leading to specific results, because then you can focus on those specific conditions. Everything being interrelated is too broad to really give you an accurate information about things. So this is why the idea of specific conditionality actually is an important point that actually gives you access to a method, a way out of the problem. And this is what this is really about. Dependent origination is this beautiful universal principle. Now, I don't know sure how much to say about this now. Is there anything you would like to add, Venerable?
In Buddhism, we don't really believe in what many other religions believe in. They believe in a God, most of the religions anyway. And I think one of the reasons that is so is that it gives you some, as if something is looking over you and taking care of you, something to trust in. As you said, you mentioned the word trust as well.
Mm.
And in Buddhism, we don't have that. But reading suttas like this, I sometimes look at it, at the Dhamma, as a little bit, not like a personal God, but like some sort of force of nature that you can always trust on. Meaning that if you do good things, then you will get good results. And if you're kind and generous, that you will get good results. It's something that you can rely on, and it gives me some sort of, as I said in the introduction, gives me some sense of stability in my life. And there is this quote by some Christian monks, I think they're called the Carthusians, and when I was a layperson, I saw a documentary on them, and they're really inspiring. They're really all quiet all day long. We are pretty quiet as well, but they are in next level quiet. They don't say anything. And they have this quote that is like the motto of their religion. And it is, the cross is steady while the world is turning. And it's, for them, it of course means there's always God while everything is changing. But it's, I feel some sort of link to Buddhism. Not to emphasize, not in the sense of a personal God or any God really, but to have this thing that you can rely on, this law of nature that persists, as it says there on the slide, that we can rely on. Mm. So I hope we can explain that law of nature to you, and we will explain dependent origination, and it's a lot about how things lead to suffering. But always remember that if we understand how things lead to suffering, that always gives us some understanding also of how to remove suffering, because that is the opposite of dependent origination, and we might call that dependent cessation maybe, is a principle that is just as valid as well, which is included in this, and that is about the cessation of suffering. So we can always rely on principles, natural principles that lead to the cessation of suffering. So I don't know, it makes me happy to think about that kind of thing. So.
Yeah. And there, one of the things that I think most modern people rely on is the laws of nature and science, and they take that as kind of the thing to trust in a sense and to rely on. And of course, there's a lot to be said for that. Science has certainly done a lot of good for the world, etc. But I was just discussing this with Ajahn Brahm in the car, and Ajahn Brahm, of course, is a physicist. And so we're discussing, how reliable are really the laws, scientific laws? How much do we really know about the world as such? And even though a lot of the laws are, we have discovered, obviously, they are true to some extent, you also notice, if you look at the history of science, we often found that the previous laws were limited in a certain way. Yeah, we had Newtonian physics, and then Einstein comes along and says, actually, Newton was right, but not, he wasn't fully right. There's more to it. Yeah, it goes broader. And then some other smart aleck comes along and says, actually, Einstein wasn't quite right either. It's going even further. So the laws of nature themselves are always we are discovering more about them. We're going deeper into them. And so that is reliable to some extent. But I think these principles of Buddhism, at least from a Buddhist point of view, these are laws of the mind, how the mind works. Yeah, you may think that rebirth is a physical thing, but rebirth really is a mental progression of the mind from one life to another one. And the physical aspect of it is not really significant. It's the mental aspect that matters. And I think these are more certain, more absolute in a sense, than the laws of, even the laws of natural laws of science, because that's just the nature of these mental laws, that they are more easily defined and more kind of final in nature. Okay. Does anyone want to say anything about any of this? Let's take another question from outside. This is from someone called Metanando. So Metanando means like delight, metta delight. That's kind of nice, isn't it? Loving kindness delight. Metanando. Okay, so the question or the comment here is, I understand that EBTs, early Buddhist texts, are the closest to the Buddha Dhamma. But how would you explain rationally to average person why the word of historical Gautama is the ultimate teaching among all teachings in history? And that is a good question. Why is it that the Buddha's teaching is kind of ultimate? How do we know that the Buddha was right? Yeah, okay, we may have discovered the teachings of the Buddha, but why are they special? And that is a much more tricky thing to actually know that. But one of the ways that you do know that, and this I think is one of the beautiful things about reading the teachings of the Buddha, is that you get this feeling when you read the word of the Buddha of someone really awesome. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm said that we should translate sadhu as awesome, and I think so. It's a good word to use in the Buddhist context. So Buddha was really, he really was special. Yeah. You read the suttas, you get this feeling that there was some spiritual genius there who were giving these teachings. The consistency over, you know, now we have it all in written form, 5,000 pages, incredible consistency. They show a path that is almost every word in the suttas is meaningful in a very positive way. There's nothing in the suttas that make you think that this person had any kind of violence in them. You know, it's kind of one of the fascinating things. It's one of the very few religious texts you will find, the suttas, the early Buddhist texts, where there's nothing really to inspire you to be violent. As a Buddhist, if you want to be violent as a Buddhist, you can't look to the suttas. You've got to find your inspiration somewhere else. Which is good news. Yeah, you cannot really justify violence at all from a Buddhist perspective, because there's nothing in the suttas really to help you justify violence. Occasionally, when you hear Buddhists justify violence, and they do sometimes, they go elsewhere. They go to other texts, which are not EBTs. They're still Pali texts, but they're outside of the early Buddhist texts. So, and this is how you start to get a feeling for the Buddha. You read this text, you see that there's someone, a genius behind this. You get this feeling for someone really awesome, amazing, special. You start to practice this teaching. You start to feel how it works in your own life, that it actually has a real effect on you. And as you do that, you gain even more faith. You look at these things, yeah, and gradually you get this sense that someone here who was very special and very unique. And this is, gradually get that feeling. But ultimately, the only way to really get this fully, of course, is to actually practice the path all the way, and then eventually gain an insight that is equivalent to what the Buddha had. And then when you gain that insight, which is equivalent to what the Buddha had, then when you read the suttas, and then you know that the person who spoke these suttas, he must have had these insights, because no one else talks in this way. There's one thing which distinguishes Buddha from everything else, and this is also a core aspect of dependent origination, and that is the idea of non-self. No other teaching has the idea of non-self in the way that Buddhism has it. So that is the answer, but it is a tricky question, and this is why it can be hard, of course, to convince other people that Buddhism is has something to give which might be different from all other teachings. Do you want to add anything to Mr. Nior?
No,
you're right, yeah? Okay,
we'll come back to that point later many times as well.
Yeah. So we have some more questions here. We have, what is enlightenment? I think we can talk about this later on. I think some of these questions we're going to have to postpone. Maybe we should put them a bit on the back burner, because I think we're going too far afield. What is your concept of God?
I just answered that.
Yeah, I guess. Okay. Yeah, you have given an answer to the rest. That's good. so we can pass that one. The next one is from Poonsiri in Thailand. Hello, Venerable. Does ignorance mean not knowing about the Four Noble Truths? Yes, it does, and we'll come back to this later on, discuss this in great detail, the idea of ignorance or avidya. And then we have from Paul Westbury, the ancient civilization's outlook, such as the Vedic, as opposed to the modern scientific, seems as if they are closer to right view. Any opinion on this? And I think this is a very interesting point. I think a very important point. I think sometimes in our modern culture we take great pride in our scientific knowledge and our understanding of the world, and I think there is, of course, some justification to that. In some ways we have an understanding of the world which is in some ways superior to what they had 2,000 years ago, and that's why we have modern technology and all of these kind of things. But in terms of spiritual things, in terms of insight into the nature of reality, understanding the mind, for example, in terms of understanding the mind, I think our contemporary, at least Western culture, in Asian culture is a bit different, but in Western culture we're really far behind when it comes to understanding the mind. We have really no clue at all about the mind. A typical understanding of the mind in modern Western culture is that it emerges from material phenomena. But as many people have argued, and these are, you know, even scientists would argue, it doesn't work as a worldview. It doesn't actually function. If you try to make the mind emerge from material phenomena, actually, it is impossible to explain how that can happen. So from that point of view, I think the, early Buddhism or some of the ancient texts, the ancient religions, had a far more better understanding of the mind. And a large part that came from the introspection of those early religions, where they did meditation practice, where they did contemplations, and where they understood the nature of the mind in a very different way from what we do now. So I think it's important to be humble. Yeah, it's a very powerful quality in our life to be humble and always to be open to learn more. And if we get too full of ourselves in our modern world, too conceited about who we are, we actually close down our ability to gain from these ancient teachings. And humble means to try to understand dependent origination as the Buddha taught it, not as we think it should be understood according to modern science or modern philosophy or whatever, and try to put ourselves into the mental framework of the Buddha and then try to understand it as he did. That is part of that humility. Without that, you are blocked. Yeah, there's no way you're going to be able to see deeper into these things. And some of these ancient cultures, even some modern cultures, they actually do have, I think, a better understanding, deeper understanding of mind, the nature of existence, than we actually have in the modern world. And this is part and parcel of why we can use these ancient teachings to give us a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose in the world, which sometimes seems really problematic. Yeah? Actually, from Buddhist point of view, the world is problematic. Okay, actually, it doesn't really matter that much. Why? Because there is something else, more profound, more deep, that we can lean on instead, as we mentioned before. Okay, so let us move on. So I mentioned before that it is a profound teaching. This is one of the things mentioned by the Buddha. And this comes out in the suttas, that this actually is one of the things the Buddha mentions. And one of the famous incidents in the suttas is where Venerable Ananda, who was the Buddha's right-hand man, actually, no, that was Venerable Sariputta. I'm not telling the truth. Venerable Sariputta was a right-hand man. He was a right-hand upatak, the right-hand kind of assistant to the Buddha, Venerable Ananda. And he looked after the Buddha for at least 20 years or so. And then on one occasion, he goes to the Buddha, and this is what he says to the Buddha. And he says to the Buddha, "It is incredible, Venerable Sir, it is amazing that this dependent origination is deep and appears deep. Yet to me, it seems as plain as can be." Okay. So it's not obvious that the Buddha would be super impressed by this. Yeah, he might. Not sure about this. So And this is interesting from a number of points of view, because remember that Venerable Ananda, he became a stream mentor. He had insight into the Dhamma fairly early on. So when the Buddha, when Venerable Ananda says, it is amazing how deep it is. Yeah, it is, but to me it is really plain. It might be that he says that he is a stream mentor, perhaps. Or it might be that he just has such great knowledge of the teachings that he understands it anyway. We don't really know exactly what he means. But what does the Buddha reply to this? Yeah, this is kind of the interesting thing here. And this is what he says. He says, this dependent origination is deep and appears deep. It is because of not understanding and not penetrating this teaching that this population has become tangled like a string, knotted like a ball of thread, and matted like rushes and reeds. And it doesn't escape the places of loss, the bad places, the underworld, and transmigration, or rebirth, if you like. So this is what the Buddha says, gently telling Ananda that maybe you actually have taken out an important part here. At the very beginning, he says to Ananda, do not say so, Ananda, do not say so. Yeah. In other words, be careful how you talk about this, because this might be more profound than what you realize. The number of interesting things in this little saying here, but one of the kind of important points here is this idea that the population, we have become tangled like string, knotted like a ball of thread, matted like rushes and reeds. Yeah, what does this mean? In what sense have we become tangled like string? Are you tangled like string? What do you feel? What does it mean? And what it means is that our network, how we relate to other people in the world, how we are part of a community, a family, a society, how we have viewpoints about things, how we have all these attachments in the world, to our home, to ideas, to things, to people, whatever it is. All of this is an entanglement, and we are entangled in all of these things. And if we try to withdraw from some of these entanglements, we just attach to something else, We can find another knot, another ball of thread somewhere, and we entangle in that. And then we try to undo this, but we can't undo it. And it's kind of fascinating. Why is it that we can't undo it? Well, because it is the nature of an ordinary human being to be entangled. Yeah, entanglement is our nature. So it's very hard to withdraw from that entanglement. And that entanglement then, because we haven't escaped from that, we haven't escaped from all the negative consequences of existence, which is carrying on from life to life, transmigration, rebirth, negative rebirth, and all of that. It carries on because of that. So you have to understand, this one says, dependent origination. When you understand dependent origination, that is when you escape from all of this suffering and all of these problems. Yeah? So now you know why you're here. we are here to try to understand this a little bit. It's also a bit scary, because on the one hand, he says it is really profound. It's really hard to understand. Maybe if even Venerable Ananda doesn't understand it properly. And yet, if you don't understand it, you have all these problems. It's kind of scary, isn't it? But this leads to the idea, why is it that the Buddha says this? Why is it deep and profound? In what sense is this the case? And it is true in at least two different ways. It is deep and profound in the sense that it is only if you practice these teachings really fully, if you have a full insight into reality, that you actually can understand dependent origination. Dependent origination is an insight into the Buddha's teachings, an understanding of what they are all about. They are really very all-encompassing. And in this sense, it is deep. But it is also deep in the sense that the implications of dependent origination, all the various things that you can draw out of it, all the little details about non-self, about how we perceive the world, about how ignorance leads to all these activities, all of these little bits and pieces that we will tease out or depend on origination over the next 6 weeks are actually very quite involved and very interesting here. And our whole life can really be explained in terms of this particular sequence. So in both of these ways, it is very important and very interesting here. So when we look at this, it's important not to get too scared, yeah? Because if we are too scared and we think, oh, if I don't understand this, then I will, you know, who knows what will happen next? Well, there is a way of understanding this, and we will look at this later on. This is the beginning, is to come to a course like this, or actually the beginning probably a long time ago. This is like a stage somewhere in there, and then eventually it leads on to realizing what this is really about. So there's nothing really to be scared about. It's just moving in that right direction, and gradually you kind of come to understand what this is. But it shows you again that this insight into dependent origination is really significant. So what does it mean to have an insight into the dependent origination here? Yeah, very briefly, because this is a very important point. When you have an insight, do you see all of the 12 links like we saw before? Bang, 12 links flashing before your inner eye. Is that what you see here? Probably not. Yeah, that's not usually how insight works. You don't see, you know, ignorance, willed activities, consciousness, name and form, like a kind of a slide. That's not really how it works. So what is it that we see when we see dependent origination? Remember that the teachings of the Buddha, they are an articulation of one insight that the Buddha had. And an insight happens in a flash. Bang, you see reality. And then the 5,000 words, or the 10,000 words, or whatever it is, 5,000 pages, actually many more words, a million words, but 5,000 pages of the suttas, of the agamas, they are an articulation of that one insight. It comes from that one insight. The same thing with dependent origination. It is an articulation in a certain way of one particular insight that happens in a flash. So what you see in that flash, you see a particular connection between certain phenomena. And the main insight in that you have is the insight that craving, yeah, or the defilements, or whatever you want to call them, these lead to rebirth. That is the main insight. We'll come back to this later on. And once you have that insight, dependent origination, these 12 links, they are an exposition in broad of that main insight. That's really what it comes back to. That makes it very simple, yeah? All you really have to understand is why craving leads to rebirth. Not only understand it, but you have to see it directly. And then everything else is a consequence of that. So that is what the Buddha is talking about here. But he's also talking about all the consequences of this particular insight. Okay, yeah.
Shall I tell it? Yes, I will. So, yeah, these teachings are about deep insight, a flash of insight or a series of insights. I have to admit, when I read this sutta earlier today, when Ajahn Ramali showed it to me, and I saw knotted like string, a joke came up in my mind, so I have to tell that now, don't I? I like jokes. So a piece of string walks into a bar.
Okay.
This has nothing to do with dependent origination, by the way.
Oh, maybe it does, deep down. Yeah. Anyway.
A piece of string walks into a bar and says to the barman, "Hey, can I have a whiskey, mate?" The barman says, "No, get out of here. We don't serve pieces of string in this bar." The piece of string really disappointed. And so he walks out, comes back the next day, and maybe he's another barman or something, he hopes. So he walks into the bar. "Hey, can I have a whiskey, mate?" The barman replies, "Hey, get out of here. We don't serve pieces of string here." Piece of string, really disappointed. He walks out, comes back the next day again. He thinks, that tactic didn't really work. Let's try something else. So what he does, he ties himself into a knot to disguise himself. And he's about to walk into the bar. And he thinks, I still look like a piece of string. So let me just get my hair and frizzle it all up and get it all loose like this. And he walks into the bar and he says, "Hey, can I have a whiskey, mate?" And the barman says, "Huh? Are you a piece of string?" And the string replies, "No, I'm afraid not.
Well done, Sunil. We were having breakfast this morning with Ajahn Brahm, and Ajahn Brahm said to the Sunil that you will be you are a real disciple. You really understand.
but I wasn't allowed to blame. He said I wasn't allowed to blame it like that. I was conditioned by Ajahn Brahm. So I couldn't say that. So it's sort of dependent condition.
Yeah. So well, yeah, good. Thank you, Ramsen, for kind of lightening the show here. That's great. Yeah. So okay. So let us move on. So the other thing I mentioned just before is that dependent origination is a very rich teaching. Yeah, it has all of these, all of the aspects of Buddhism really comes into dependent origination. So I'll just briefly go through with you the sort of things that is included. Would you mind not knocking, tapping the thing anymore?
Get the mouse working
afterwards, yeah. Oops. Uh-oh.
It's not working.
Not working. Okay, thank you. Oh, too many.
Oh.
Uh-oh.
There we go.
Is that the right one? Yeah, okay. Thank you. So the first thing, as we have already seen, it includes the idea of rebirth within it. Yeah, and of course, rebirth is a very important part. You read the suttas, every other sutta is about rebirth in one way or another. So a big topic right there comes into dependent origination here. And of course, part of rebirth is the idea of kamma, the idea that there is a way in which rebirth happens according to certain cause and conditions. And that also comes into dependent origination. If you look at dependent origination, the second factor, sankhara, we saw willed activities, really is the idea of kamma. Yeah? So rebirth and kamma are in there. What else? Exciting. Five aggregates, yeah? Five aggregates, a very important part of the Buddhist teachings. If you look at some of the suttas, there are a large number of suttas about the five aggregates. In fact, there's a whole collection of about 160 suttas all about the five aggregates. And dependent origination is a particular way of looking at the five aggregates, how they express themselves over time, how they change, how they evolve. Yeah, it's the evolution of the five aggregates over time. And they're all mentioned in there in one way or another. And their evolution is really what is explained by dependent origination. Then we have the process of perception, another important teaching that you find in the suttas. This refers to how we experience the world, how that experience of the world happens. We're going to look at this in quite a lot of detail later on. But the basic Buddhist idea is that when you have a sense organ, you have an object, you have an eye, and you have things you can see, then consciousness arises based on that, and then you experience the world. And that process is a very important part, and this also is included in dependent origination. We have the six senses. They are specifically mentioned in dependent origination, part of the process of perception. Then we have the three characteristics, the tilakkhana. Another very important part of the Buddhist teachings. And the three characteristics are impermanence, suffering, and non-self. Yeah? So we know that the dependent origination, it ends with suffering. So the suffering characteristic is right there. A very important part of dependent origination is the idea of non-self. The core reason why the Buddha taught this teaching here, and this is what you find in some of the suttas, is to explain how the world works without a sense of self. It's the core reason what this is about. So very significant. So this is a very important aspect. And I'll talk about this at length later on, because it actually is very, very interesting and very important. Some of the suttas are directly about that. And the third characteristic is impermanence. And the whole sequence of dependent origination is a sequence of causality, how things arise according to causes. And when things arise according to causes, it means precisely that they are unreliable, they are impermanent, they come about not because of some essential aspect to them, but they come about because of a previous cause. And when that previous cause disappears, then the effect also disappears. And that previous cause is dependent on another previous cause. And that previous cause depends on another previous cause. There's causes all the way down. All the way down there's causes. I don't know if you know that as a, you know, the saying about, you know, what the world is kind of, what is the world supported by? It's supported by a turtle. Yeah, the world is kind of a primitive idea of the world. The world rests on the back of a turtle. Yeah. So if you have this view, you ask the person, well, what does a turtle stand on then? If you have, you know, kind of trying to dissuade people from a silly view, what does a turtle stand on? It stands on another turtle. Huh? So what does the other turtle stand on? Oh, it stands on another turtle. Huh? And then what? And, you know, so how does this end? Oh, no, there's turtles all the way down. Yeah? It doesn't make any sense, right? Because there is no bottom. Yeah, that's kind of the whole point. And but Buddhism is, there's causes and conditions all the way down. Yeah, that's the Buddhist idea. There's no final turtle that everything stands on. There's no turtles in Buddhism. Actually, there is, but different context. And the turtles, there's not turtles, there's causes and conditions all the way down. So there's no inherent essence that things eventually stand on. That's the idea of impermanence. All the three characteristics are fundamental part of dependent origination here. Then we have the importance of death is right there. Yeah, it ends with death and old age, dependent origination here. And then we have the idea of ignorance and knowledge. And of course, the whole purpose of Buddhism is ultimately to give rise to knowledge and understanding. And dependent origination directly deals with that idea of how to overturn our ignorance and make it into some knowledge instead. And the last one was that? Four Noble Truths. Yeah. So, and this is, again, it is the very first part of dependent origination. The very definition of ignorance is being ignorant about the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths are like everything, really. So it shows you that this teaching really encompasses everything here. So this is just to give you an idea of how rich this teaching is and how it really includes all other teachings of Buddhism in one way or another. It's all part and parcel of this teaching, and we will draw this out of these 12 factors as we go along over the next 6 weeks. So there you are. Okay. So what happens then when you see dependent origination, right? I mentioned before that the purpose is to see dependent origination. What is it that you see? Well, this is it. This is what you see. Would you like to see that? Or would you rather not see that? I think I'd rather not see that, actually. It looks pretty scary. This is a graphic kind of set out of dependent origination in the Tibetan tradition. Yeah, and you have the 12 factors going around the perimeter there, and then in the middle you have greed, hatred, and delusion, and then you have this demon on the outside, yeah, eating everything. And this demon, I think, is Yama, the god of the underworld, yeah, eating everything. You always it's a demon of death, because dependent origination shows you how death always comes about as a consequence of that ignorance. So this is dependent origination. So this is what you, hopefully not exactly what you see at stream entry, otherwise I don't think anyone wants to become a stream entry, but it is something like this. Yeah, when you become a stream entry, you actually see dependent origination. And this is what the Buddha has to say about this. Again, a quote from the suttas. One who sees dependent origination sees the teaching, the Dhamma, and one who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. So you, it is equivalent to understanding the whole jigsaw puzzle of Buddhism. That is what you see, and of course you see that at stream entry. And the very last slide for this morning, because we're going to have to go and have lunch in a second. This is where the Buddha again talks about, here let's just read it out. And what is the noble method? This is Nyaya in Pali. That they had clearly seen and comprehended with wisdom. So these are the stream enterers, right? A noble disciple properly attends to dependent origination here. So one of the reasons why I included this particular slide is because this word Nyaya is a word that many of you might be familiar with. Yeah, whenever you do the chanting of the to the triple gem in Pali, yeah, you chant the homage to the Sangha. It goes Supatipanno, Supadipanno Bhagavato Sarvaka Sango. Yeah? The disciples of the Buddha are well practiced. And then you have Niyaya, which is this word here. Niyaya Patipanno Bhagavato Sarvaka Sango. Yeah? So the disciples of the Buddha, they practice Patipanno, this Niyaya. Yeah? And so what is this Niyaya? And we often chant these things, we kind of bow down to the Buddha, and these are very powerful and nice chants, and I really encourage people to understand them. And this is what you are chanting when you chant that word, the Niyaya, the method practiced by the noble disciples. What they understand is the dependent origination method. That is that insight. So next time you chant Niyaya Patipanno, think dependent origination, yeah? This is what it means. So the Aryas, the noble ones, they practice according to this. They practice according to the cessation mode of dependent origination, and they have an insight into what these teachings are. That is just to give you a little bit of more extra background to that important chant that we often do in the Buddhism. Okay, so 2 hours have just disappeared, vanished into thin air. So is there any last questions before we head off for lunch? Any last comments? Anyone want to say anything here? Everyone is okay here? Yeah? Can you understand what is going on? Yeah? Yeah, everyone okay? Can you understand what I say? Am I speaking too fast, too slow, too average, or too... Okay. Can you understand Venerable Sunyo's jokes? Wow, that is important. If you can, then you are in business.
Oh, sadhu!
Sadhu. Okay, so let's have a break then for lunch, and we'll see you back here again at 12 o'clock. Just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.